The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Back in 2015, I interviewed Susan Southard for a book called Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. And the book is amazing. And during the interview, I suggested to her that she need to have her publisher submit a copy of the book for consideration for the Dayton Literary Peace Prize for nonfiction, because it was just that powerful. I thought it was a real contender for the prize. And she clearly, during the interview, was not even aware of such a prize existing. And I think she was flattered and slightly amused. Well, the following year, it won the Dayton Literary Peace Prize. And we did another interview with her. And the Dayton Literary Peace Prizes are celebrating their 20th anniversary this year. And Susan Southard is going to be coming here to do an event on Thursday, May 15th. And she's being brought in by the Dayton Literary Peace Prize Foundation, also the Dayton Metro Library and the University of Dayton. And I'm going to give you all that information. But first, let's listen to my original interview with Susan Southard, recorded back in 2015. This is the first one, and just a portion of it. If you want to listen to the entire interview, you can go to our website at wyso.org and listen to that interview, as well as the one the following year after she had won the Dayton Literary Peace Prize. Here's Susan Southard talking about Nagasaki on the best of the Book Nook.
I thought it was really important that this story about post-nuclear survival get out.
Why is it so little known?
It's a good question. It seems so obvious that it wouldn't be, but really even the Hiroshima and Nagasaki, mostly what people imagine is kind of an abstract image of mass destruction, and possibly if people have read John Hersey's book, which was written in 1946, they know a little bit about some aftermath issues, including the radiation illnesses and death that came to follow. But there has really been nothing written about the next 69 years, and I think that, there are a lot of reasons that there was censorship imposed on the news within Japan by the U.S. occupation forces. There was denial and kind of suppression of the story here in the United States in the post-war years in order to hold opposition to the decision to use the bombs to try to contain that, and people were relieved that the war was over. Japanese were hated by many Americans, people saw that, or people believed and were told that the atomic bombs ended the war, and so seeing the other half of the story wasn't part of what people may have been interested in at the time.
Susan Southard joins us. The book is Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. Nagasaki was kind of an afterthought then, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't an afterthought. The order, President Truman's order to deliver atomic bombs on Japan, on the targeted cities selected, was as they were made ready. And on August 6th, the Hiroshima bomb was delivered. And although it had been moved up a little bit and hurried because of weather conditions in Japan. The Nagasaki bomb was readied within 3 days and was delivered. There was no second order or any separate military analysis for the second bomb. It was part of a single order by President Truman to drop them as they were ready.
I guess when I described it as an afterthought, I was more referring to the descriptions of what happened. It's like Hiroshima gets all the coverage.
Oh, yes, you're so right, Vic. That I've been amazed at a number of people that I talk to, even in my everyday life, who don't even know the name of Nagasaki. People old enough to know and or know that there was a second atomic bombing at all. And there are perhaps a number of reasons that happened too. The most basic is that Hiroshima, being the first city bombed in history, has kind of taken over as name Hiroshima has become an icon across the world for the kind of the birth of the nuclear age, I think.
And along that same line, we're familiar with the story of the Enola Gay, the plane that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. I was not familiar with the sequence of events in the second bomb until I read your book, and the fact that they flew over a completely different city. They were ready to drop the bomb on different people.
That's right. I think most people don't know that. The city that was to be the second atomic bomb target that morning was the city of Kokura, which was about 150 miles northeast of Nagasaki on the same island, which is the southernmost island of Kyushu, the southernmost main island of Japan, which is called Kyushu. And the scouting plane that went that flew over Kokura earlier that morning reported that the skies were clear, and the order was to deliver the bomb by visual sighting only of the target. And by the time the B-29 and its accompanying plane arrived over Kokura, cloud and smoke cover had blocked visibility of the city. And ironically, the smoke cover had come from a nearby city that had been firebombed the day before. And the winds had shifted that morning, and now the smoke was going over Kokura. So the pilots circled over the city several times. They were shot at a bit, but weren't, seriously, the planes weren't seriously harmed. And finally, they had to be very cautious about their fuel consumption, and they finally turned and flew in the direction of Nagasaki.
And they had a visibility issue in Nagasaki, too, did they not?
Yes, they did. Nagasaki, too, was covered in clouds. And in fact, they made a split-second decision to go against orders and drop the bomb by radar instead of by visual sighting. Although I should correct that a little bit, the bombardier on the boxcar, the plane that carried the bomb, did see the city through a hole in the clouds for a split second and said, I got it, and then they dropped the bomb. But they had made the decision to drop it by radar before he was able to see the hole in the clouds.
Your book is a work of journalism. You did all this reporting and all this interviewing. You don't tell us what to think or what to feel, but it's hard not to have an opinion after reading this book. I think that anyone who reads it might think twice about why we bombed Japan this way.
Yes, I mean, they're really one of the difficult aspects of the atomic bomb story that we have been told and that we continue to tell is that it reflects on the political and military considerations around the bombings, either that they were needed or that they weren't needed. There's still very contentious debate about that by historians. But remarkably and unfortunately, I think that this way of speaking about the bombs completely leaves out the second half of the story, which is what happened to the people beneath both mushroom clouds at the time of the bombings and over 70 years. And it indeed has been a full lifetime of both suffering and survival, recovery, and trying to figure out how a person redefines normalcy in a life split by nuclear war.
President Truman did acknowledge in some way that these were innocent civilians, didn't he?
Yes, he did, rather indirectly in I believe it was a memo. He never apologized. He never publicly and seemingly personally. I haven't read every biography about him, but he didn't seem to regret it. The bombing. I remember one quote being that he didn't lose sleep over it, but he did acknowledge that they were civilians at one point. And indeed, in Nagasaki, out of the initial 75,000 who died and 74,000 who were injured, which doesn't count the people who suffered in the years that followed from radiation illness and death. Out of the first 75,000, only 150 were military personnel. So it really was a civilian population that was obliterated there.
The book is Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. Susan Southern is the author. She joins us in the Book Nook today. Your descriptions of the impact of the bomb and the ensuing nightmare. It's tough reading.
It was tough writing as well. It was so dramatic, and so I'm talking about the initial what was happening on the ground when the bomb exploded, and then of course in the aftermath with the radiation. It's so dramatic and so terrifying, and really, you know, even as hard as it is to read and for me to have written, that's so much less than actually experiencing it. And the radiation illness that followed, that, you know, the first wave started within a week or so after the bombing, where people came down with these horrific and mysterious symptoms of purple spots all over their bodies and high fevers and infections rampant through their bodies and organs and losing their hair and their gums swelling and bleeding. All of this was denied in the United States and then kind of suppressed. So we don't know these details of what really happened to the people in both cities. And it is difficult to read. I'm hopeful that people will be able to bear with the difficulty in order to not look away, number one, and to know that it was really far worse than what I'm able to express in words these many years later.
I felt it was very important to read it, even though it was very hard to read.
I think
that we need to know this. We need to know what happened to these people.
And I think I agree, and I think it's relevant to today's current events as it relates to, you know, the nuclear treaty with Iran. Whether, you know, no matter what one's position, I think it's really important that we understand, not abstractly, but more specifically, the effects of nuclear weapons. So that we, all of us, are more educated and understand what we're talking about on a human level, as well as knowing the political and military complexities, both with Iran and around the world.
I grew up in a house where my dad was a military veteran, and he didn't talk about the war too much. He, in particular, he never talked about Nagasaki, but he was one of those 2nd Division Marines who went in there after the surrender. And
into Nagasaki?
Yes, in his desk drawer, he had hundreds of photos that he took. But he never talked about it.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Yeah. So Nagasaki was definitely a part of my family history. When I found out that people didn't talk much about it, I was surprised, I guess because I looked through my own particular viewpoint at it and knew it was a big part of my own family story. And I've often thought about my father, what he must have thought when he went there.
Oh, my goodness, yes. It was very dramatic for those 2nd Marines and the other occupation forces who came into Nagasaki just over a month after the bombing, when people were, you know, the city was flattened, most of the city. There was part of the city that was still, you know, kind of in existence, although the buildings were damaged. But the entire northern valley of the city was gone, and not only were people still there were cremation pyres, throughout the atomic plain, makeshift cremation pyres that continued to burn through much of the fall from the people who were injured and died, and then there were these massive numbers of deaths from the radiation illness that were the people needed to be their bodies needed to be cremated as well. So there were accounts that I read of some of the U.S. troops that had entered who spoke about, you know, destruction beyond anything they could have imagined, and then the stench and the grief that was so heavy in the city.
He was on a survey crew. They went out and they surveyed what was...
Is that right?
...what was left, and of course he didn't talk about it, but... We looked at the photos, and they were just total destruction.
Did you see the photos while he was alive?
Oh,
did
sure.
Did he show them to you?
No.
He showed them to
we
you?
Were, no, you? We were snooping in his desk. He never showed them to us.
Oh.
It's a whole drawer full of them. Little tiny black and white photos. My brother still has them. Yeah. He took them.
Oh, what a story.
Yeah. Well, we knew not to ask him about the pictures. He never talked about it.
Oh. How did it affect you knowing that this story existed in his life, but you're knowing that he wasn't speaking about it and having seen the photos?
Well, I wondered about radiation. I wondered how that had affected him.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered.
Yes.
I don't think they probably told them anything about where they were and where they were sending them. I get the sense that everything was just kind of done on the fly. They let the genie out of the bottle, but they didn't know what they let out.
It's so true. They didn't. There's certainly, I met in Nagasaki while on one of my trips there, some veterans who entered the city after the bombing, who had, from what I understand, there are many more who had lifelong health problems, really serious health problems. With cancers that were far more than a typical person. And I don't think that is able to be scientifically attributable, so I don't think it's been an easy course for them. But they definitely strongly believe that it came from their exposure to the residual radiation still in the city, which the U.S. military deemed safe at the time. I don't have enough information to know if there's any reason to doubt that assessment. The hard line that the bombs ended the war and saved millions of lives is too simplistic for the complexity of what happened in those last few days before Japan surrendered.
I hear what you're saying, and I'm sure many of our listeners do too. So much of this is about indoctrination. We look at the way that the Japanese were indoctrinated. You talk to these people and they talk about the culture and the war footing that the nation of Japan was on and the things that they were taught to believe and think. Mm. And on our side as well.
Yes, it was, do you mean during the war?
Yes, and before.
Yes, really on both sides. There's an amazing, fabulous book called War Without Mercy by John Dower, a Pulitzer Prize-winning book on the, oh no, I don't, I'm afraid I don't know for sure which book he won the Pulitzer Prize for, but it's basically covers the powerful, intense racism on either side, on both sides, mm-hmm. toward the enemy, that not only objectified and made the people of the other nation different than us, or us different from the Japanese, but really demeaned them in ways that was pretty phenomenal, making them less than human, I think because of all of that rhetoric and indoctrination, particularly in the U.S. at the time, it made it easier to accept all the incendiary, all the firebombings that were going on, killing hundreds of thousands of Japanese citizens, and then also being able to accept and justify and feel fine about the atomic bombings, the atomic bombs being dropped.
Well, that's how we learn to hate. You know, who do we hate mm-hmm. this week? Muslims? You know, that's just, that's the way it's done.
Yeah, it's something to be very attentive to. It was interesting, Yoshida Katsuji, the young boy who was 13 and whose face was disfigured, he would get up in front of school children, and at first they cried, and he was mortified, and he could barely tolerate it. He wanted to speak about his experience and teach them about peace, but at first he couldn't. But after a while, he got more comfortable and very, very sweet, and he would tell them jokes at first to make them laugh. And one of the things that really touched me about his way of talking with children is he would say, "Have you ever looked up the word heiwa, which is the Japanese word for peace, in the dictionary?" Mm. And no one in the audience ever had. And the children, he said, "Let's look it up." And he would read the definition. And then he would look at them and say, you know, or he said to me, "They don't know this because they're in peacetime." But he said, "We need to pay attention to peace." And he teaches that to them. And he brought a different level of awareness to me when he said that we are not in peacetime, but in the United States we are. I mean, the wars that the United States is fighting and struggling with in regions across the Middle East and Afghanistan are outside of our territory. And I think it's important for all of us to pay attention to what supports and maintains peace, even though we are, as a nation, we're not at peace. It's not the same situation. But as we consider various military actions, I guess, in areas of the world that are threatened right now.
The book is Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. Susan Southard wrote it here in Dayton, Ohio, where we had the Dayton Peace Accords. We now have what we call the Dayton Literary Peace Prizes for literature. They're for fiction and nonfiction. And I think you need to be sure to tell your publisher to submit your book next year for consideration.
Thank you so much.
Okay?
That's very kind of you, Vic. Thank you.
I think this is a very powerful book, and I think it fits right in with what they're looking for. You've been listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO, going back 10 years. To my first interview with Susan Southard for her book about Nagasaki, Life After Nuclear War. You heard it on 91.3 WYSO, sharing community voices through inspired storytelling. And this is the 20th anniversary of the Dayton Literary Peace Prizes. Also, 80 years ago, the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Also, this month, the 80th anniversary of Victory in Europe Day. And this Thursday, presented by the Dayton Literary Peace Prize Foundation, the Dayton Metro Library, and the University of Dayton, Susan Southard will be here for a special event. And that's at UD's Roger Glass Center for the Performing Arts, 29 Creative Way in Dayton, from 6:30 until 8 o'clock. And there will be a reception at 5:30. And you can attend, but you need to RSVP. You need to reserve a spot. I'm sure they're not charging. They just want to know how many people are going to be there. So you can contact the Dayton Metro Library. Go to their website, daytonmetrolibrary.org. Or here's the phone number. And this is the number I got from the library, so I'm sure this is the right one. 937-463-2665. That's 937-463-2665. Once again, this event is this Thursday, May 15th, 6:30 to 8 o'clock at the Roger Glass Center for the Performing Arts at UD. There will be a reception at 5:30. The talk will begin at 6:30 until 8 o'clock. So you can participate. I'm sure it will be worth attending and very valuable information to learn about the nuclear attacks on Nagasaki and about peace. The Dayton Literary Peace Prize Foundation presenting this. And at the end of that interview, that was the original one I did with her in 2015, you heard me suggest to her that this book is so good. It's such a well-done book, so powerful, that she should have her publisher submit it for consideration for a Dayton Literary Peace Prize. And they did, and it won the following year. And we had her on the program again after it won. And when I suggested it to her initially, did you notice that she didn't really even seem to be aware that such a prize existed? So I am so pleased that they submitted it, because this book is so worth reading. And as you also heard during that excerpt, Nagasaki is personal for me because my dad was in the 2nd Division of the U.S. Marine Corps. And after the surrender of Japan, they sent in his guys into Nagasaki to survey the wreckage. And my dad never talked about that. But we did find the photos in his desk drawer, little tiny black and white photos that showed the destruction. And from what I understand, you weren't supposed to be taking photos. My dad apparently was doing that on the sly. And I believe my nephew now has possession of those photos of Nagasaki after the nuclear attack. You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. Stay tuned to your public radio station, WYSO.